book even, which is book 10. And even worse, since I've read that book, it's even better than our book, which I absolutely need. So, I've read many, many books on Aboriginal history. I've read this one book, The Melbourne Dream, which is absolutely brilliant. You should all read that. I wrote that about 1997. But when you read all these books, it's like the witnesses to a car accident. They all see things, many of them are brilliant, but they all see things from their different perspectives. One from the native police, one from the perspective of the mission, etc. But I think in Richard's book, for the first time ever I've seen, he's put together the entire story. It's a wonderful experience, an opportunity for the reader and interested in the subject. So thanks, Richard, for coming along, and thank you.
I was going to show a PowerPoint.
You want this, John?
Just put it in and it should
just work.
I think you did ask Richard to bring along books, his book, because it's a great opportunity to purchase the book, and they're actually $5 cheaper today.
$15
cheaper today. So
$25.
$25. So if anybody wants to take that opportunity, it's it'd be great to do that today.
So I'll just grab one. Wow. So look, I'm not trying to shamelessly flog this because I don't make a cracker out of it, in the sense that I'll give it to you for what I buy from the publisher for $25. But authors love to be read, don't they?
They do.
And look, I'm delighted to be here, and I'll be delighted to show you a couple of slides. Once it's the compressed
one.
And if I just bring it up, we can do the slide share. And then I can just advance it into view.
Yes,
like
from the beginning.
Alright, well thank you and for having me, and I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners as Mayor did. That's extremely important, and it's wonderful to see that being done these days. So I guess we should start at the beginning of the traumatic story. In the early part of the 19th century was that global forces crashed in on Aboriginal people in Victoria. You had the intro, first of all, of pathogens. And to understand this story, people have talked about the concept of ecological imperialism. That is, there's a whole ecology change, and probably the most dramatic change Victoria has ever witnessed, because there was not only the change of power relationships between the people, but there was an ecological change as well. And that was first ushered in by new pathogens, new germs coming into this world of Aboriginal Victoria. Around about 1790, there was a smallpox outbreak in Sydney, and that smallpox outbreak eventually came down and had an impact on Victoria. It's not known where this came from. There's still a debate that can't really be solved, whether it came from the First Fleet or whether it came from the Macassans. But given that smallpox was endemic in Southeast Asia, given that the Macassan traders came yearly, many crows came over together, tripang and other products, then I think it's quite likely that the smallpox did come from there. But it was a coincidence that it broke out within 2 years of the First Fleet arriving. But wherever it came from, there's very, very strong evidence that it was smallpox that had an impact on Aboriginal people in Victoria, the southeast of Australia, but not Gippsland, around about 1790. Now, what's the implications of that? We know from people who have no experience of diseases in North America and other parts of the New World, once a new disease hit, it had enormous impact. And from the North American evidence and the evidence we have from early Sydney, at least half of the people would have died from a smallpox outbreak. Those who survived would have had immunity, but there was another outbreak in about 1830 that went through many of the Aboriginal peoples of the southeast part of Australia, and again that would have probably taken about another 20% or so of the population out. So there's an enormous shock from this first wave of ecological imperialism, where a new set of parameters coming in. Of course, the germs were followed by weeds and new stock, and they had an enormous impact on the landscape. Stock ate out some of the traditional foods and grasses. They worked like jackhammers on the ground, toughened it up, and then those most prodigious of Red Cross operators in the world of flora was the weeds that came in and occupied those grounds made bare by the stock. So you had a real ecological change in what was growing in the land. And of course, with these came Europeans who believed that they were here to occupy the land. They believed the government gave them permission to be there, and so they occupied the land. So you have this whole suite of disease, of new animals and new species, and of people who have superior numbers, not so much supply power in the early years, but numbers, because Europe just kept coming. So if people were died on the frontier or were killed by warriors, then there are always more to come. So what we're facing, you know, is an onslaught on Aboriginal Victoria, what is unprecedented in their history and our history. And so you could frame Aboriginal people as the victims of ecological imperialism, which they were. They were the victims of this massive onslaught. But I think that's only part of the story, and I think we need to see history in a whole complex way. And so I want to talk about another aspect of what was going on in Victoria, and I want to talk about Aboriginal agency. By that word agency, I mean that Aboriginal people have some power to act, and I think that power to act was stronger in the early part, where the options were more open, where the European numbers and the force of government control was less in that first 10 or 15 or 25 years. But of course Aboriginal exertion of agency in their own view of the world has not ceased after those first 25 years. So I'll be talking about what Aboriginal people did over 150 years or so to try and resist what we might call settler colonialism.
I might just use that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, here we have a man called Therema, and he actually owned land around the edge of the bay, and so he would have been the traditional owner in the early 1830s of this area here. Now, Therema's a very interesting person because in the first moments of John Pascoe Faulkner's party unloading supplies in August 1835, Faulkner wasn't there, of course, but his men unloading things from the Enterprise, Derrimut befriended one of the young men, and they talked as best they could without knowing each other's language, with signs, etc. And then young man came and told Faulkner that they were going to be attacked by Aborigines. And that was known because William Buckley, as you know, the convict who had lived for 33 years amongst Aboriginal people, had come into the settlement, and he was able to translate the words that Derrimut was saying. So a warning had gone out to the Europeans that you'd be killed. Now, Derrimut then attaches himself to Faulkner. And very soon he becomes Faulkner's huntsman. He has use of Faulkner's boat, his gun, and he's the gamekeeper for Faulkner, and they exchange names. Now Faulkner thinks this is very odd. He writes in his diary, Derrimut exchanged names with me today. Now, he just wrote that. Now what does that mean? Well, names are extremely important in Aboriginal society. You've all seen films where they say, you know, the names of people in this film now deceased should not be mentioned and may cause offence. Names are powerful in Aboriginal society. And most people had several names through their life depending upon their totemic relationship to the world around them. So that names were powerful, and so when he changes names with Faulkner, he's doing something very significant, and Faulkner didn't realise it, but of course anthropologists know that he was trying to attach himself to Faulkner. Now kinship is the most motivating social operation in Aboriginal society. Everyone in Aboriginal society work out who they're related to. And if you, a new person comes into the group, they say, well, what's your family and where are you from? So kinship's extremely important. So what Derrimut was trying to do, in essence, was trying to control Faulkner. He was trying to control Faulkner by bringing him into a kinship relationship. And that was all that they could do. They couldn't outgun these people that arrived, that they could try and enmesh them into a kinship relationship and therefore control a very difficult situation. So that's what Derrimut does. Later on, he has a grave up in the General Cemetery which says to the noble Derrimut, who warned the party of an impending disastrous attack on them, and so he gets honoured in a white grave. And some historians have called him a collaborator. I don't see him as a collaborator. He was actually the clan head in his own group. So that's very odd if someone with a lot of power in their own society collaborates with the enemy. Usually it's powerless people who want something who collaborate. I think what he was doing was, it was a politics. The upcountry blacks wanted to kill them for their goods. Derrimut wanted to deal with them in another way. That is through politics, diplomacy and kinship. So that's one of the early strategies that Aboriginal people used. That was to enmesh Europeans into their world. And I think you can see that this is going on throughout that early period of frontier. And here is a picture of early Melbourne, and I think Aboriginal people saw this as their place. It wasn't just the European place, it was their land. It was being transformed, of course, by streets and paving and houses and trees being chopped down, but they still saw it as theirs. And so they came into Melbourne frequently, in great numbers. At times there were 200 or 300 people camped by the hour around 1840-41, trying to work out what these Europeans were doing, looking at what they were doing. And there were cultural entanglements going on. Not just cultural contact, but entanglements, because they were starting to learn something about each other's world. Now that learning was mostly on the side of Aboriginal people. Say, the Europeans thought they didn't have to learn Aboriginal languages. They didn't really have to know anything about such people. They referred to as savages. But Aboriginal people were very curious. And so they tried to get access to some of the things in the new culture they wanted, particularly guns. They loved guns, and when they got guns, they just fired them off at night just for the damn heck of it, you know, because they made a great noise and whatever. They didn't use them in warfare, and that's a very interesting thing. And they even said it was a cowardly thing to use a gun in warfare. You had to use traditional things. They also, another thing they liked of the Europeans were dogs. The sort of the European dog, much more effective than the semi-domesticated dingo as a hunter, could be used as a watchdog. I believe dingoes don't have any or much of a bark, and they were fantastic on cold nights. And we've all heard the expression, it's a two-dog night, and I reckon it's been a two-dog night, maybe a three-dog night late in Melbourne. And so they embraced the dog, they embraced the gun, they embraced flour, tea and sugar and all these things, but nothing else interested them in it in European society, just a few material artifacts. but they were good learners and very good at languages, so very soon they're speaking a form of English, and they're heard to be singing, going around Melbourne singing Scottish songs and other things in a perfect Scottish brogue, such was their fine ear for languages, because of course they know many dialects and whatever. So the two societies are being entangled, and that is also giving Aboriginal people some power in this difficult situation. They're getting access to some of the things they want. You know, sharp blades out of old bottles and things that they can cut materials with. And of course metal axe heads were extremely valuable to them as well. Now, this man here, Billy Valeri, was an elder of the Wurrung people, which was the... So he was an elder of the next clan group to Derrima. And the Wurrung, their land was on the other side of the Yarra, around the Werribee and up the country a bit. Now, Billy Valeri, I think he was in his late 30s, when the Europeans came. He was actually one of the signatories of the Batman Treaty, and he is an extremely interesting man, because he gets very friendly with William Thomas, who was the Aboriginal protector in the late 1830s, and Thomas and he have a real cultural dialogue. They sit around the fire together. Billy Valeri spends the night in Thomas's camp. He has breakfast with Thomas and Mrs. Thomas, and they talk constantly, and Thomas goes on journeys out into the country for 2 or 3 days with Billy Valeri. And Billy Valeri is a very interesting person. He's a very flexible person. He tries to engage with European culture. He sends his son to the first European mission school. He joins the native police himself. He is interested in trying new things, but he's also very much a traditionalist. And when he finally gets ill in 1846 from what was called the cough, probably influenza, one of those other diseases that carried off many Aboriginal people, then when he gets ill with the cough, he goes through with some other people a ceremony of trying to find who the culprits are. He believes sorcery worked against him by someone else over the horizon, another Aboriginal group who are at enmity with him. And so a little ritual is done, and there's a pretty much sort of court proceedings, and they reckon it's that group over the mountains, and some young guys go off to seek revenge, which Thomas is very sad about, because he felt he had made headway with Billy Valeri, and then he falls back in tradition. But he was traditional all along. He was just trying some new things in order to engage with these powerful ones that had come on his doorstep and are not leaving. And in fact, by adding 40-42, there's probably 20,000 Europeans in the Melbourne region. So Billy Valeri, I think, is someone who uses his intelligence to engage in a difficult situation. And I believe he comes out with a concept which I call, in a recent bit of writing I've done, radical hope. Radical hope, because he hopes that there would be a way that tradition could survive in this new world of new colonial world. And it was Billy Valeri who in 1843 said to Thomas that he wanted some land, and he would set down it with his people and farm it like white people. So he was wanting, I think, to remain Aboriginal, but realising the realities of the new world was that you had to be in the farming economy. Hunting and gathering would no longer work, because the land was being tied up and taken and appropriated by white settlers. So the radical hope was to change, to become an agriculturalist, but to remain Aboriginal. And I think that's a radical hope that, in fact, many Aboriginal personalities and groups and communities had carried on then for the next 100 or 50 years. And perhaps that's the radical hope still of Aboriginal groups today, to remain, you know, deeply and truly Aboriginal, but also to work out a way to engage with the modern world and way of doing things. Now this is of course a picture of the native beliefs, and again I think that they're making the engagement with European culture, that is, in, on their own terms. The native police was thought up by McConachie, who was a prison reformer. He was the one that introduced the mark system at Norfolk Island, which said that if people behaved well they would get some marks of approval, and once you got so many marks you would get a remission on your sentence. So he was trying to introduce hope into that very dismal place of Norfolk Island. Now McConachie came to Melbourne and he said, look, what we need is a native police that will be models. These men will become models of other Aboriginal people who will see that it's a good thing to get a job, to start to learn the art of cleanliness and orderliness and discipline, and the native police therefore would be a role model for the rest of Aboriginal people. That's what the Europeans wanted. And of course Aboriginal people joined it, but I think for their own reasons. And they joined it in large numbers. There was 22 men joined it on the first day. This is the third attempt to get one going, but the successful attempt was when Billy Valeri and Thomas got together, and Thomas and he addressed the rest of the group and said, this is what the deal will be. You know, you'll have this, 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 and whatever. And so 22 of them joined. Now, the interesting thing is to look at this picture and ask why they joined. Well, you'll see it, can't you? This is the Monaro or the Ferrari of the 1840s. Wouldn't every young man want one of those? These were prized items. Not many people had horses in 1841 or 2 in Melbourne. They were the fastest thing around. They were exciting and whatever. So these men joined because they would have access to a horse. But look, also, they had access to a uniform with leather, red leather, and caps, and braid, and brass buckles. But they also had access to metal swords, to sabres. And, I don't know whether you can see it here, they had access to guns. So this was a young man's dream, to have access to these things. And you had rations, and you got paid. And you had a position in society, because this force could actually arrest white people. So you can see they were going for this for their own reasons. And it's very, very interesting. Murray Fells has shown this in a wonderful book called Good Men and True. The first 22 recruits were all clan heads or important people in their society. That is very significant, isn't it? She did some very close biographical work. So I think what we can see is these people are joining, but they're powerful people in their own society. So it suggests that they're trying to enlarge their power. It's a very clever political strategy. You've got power in your own world, and you're trying to get power in the new scary colonial world, and to again bring some control to it. And here's a young man, I don't know whether you've seen this picture before, but this young man was Charles Nevar. Now he wasn't always Charles Nevar. His first name was Charlie. He was a young boy, one of a family brought in when there was belief that there was a white woman trapped and held by the savages of Gippsland. There was a great myth, and about three or four posses of noble white young men went out to try and save this maiden supposedly held. I don't think that she ever existed, but Charlie was brought in as one of the family, maybe implicated in knowing something. His father died, his mother left. Charlie and his brother were put into the Mary Creek School. And at the Mary Creek School, every week or fortnight or month, the patrons of the school used to ride out from Melbourne, and they'd get the young boys to hold their horses while they went in to see how the school was doing. And so these young boys, I think, got ideas. And Charlie said to his teacher, I would like to become a gentleman. He said, what do you mean, Charlie? You can't become a gentleman. He said, besides, I haven't got two names. He said, I'll call myself Charles Nevar. And then he said, but, well, you know, and so Charlie assumed the name Charles Nevar, and then did a very clever thing. He got himself apprenticed to a person in Melbourne
in Collingwood, and that person was a tailor. So Charlie was able to learn how to make his own product. And so he started to dress like this, and he went around Melbourne leaving calling cards saying, Charles never has arrived and I've told him this true, but I'll be back again, you know. I think a lot of the Melbourne people thought this was a real joke, of course. And I thought, oh, is Charlie a joke? Is he going over to the other side, mimicking, aping gentlemen? But then I found out that Charlie said to his school teacher, former school teacher, that he was going to write a letter to the Queen. And he said, well, you've got to go through the proper channel, Charlie. And he said, I want to write a letter to the Queen. He said, I'm going to ask her for some land at Pentridge and £400, which is about 10 years of a shepherd's salary, a lot of money. £400 and a piece of land, and she will give it to me if she is a good woman. And so he had a moral stance and a political stance. He said, you know, our land has been taken, I deserve to have some land given back. And so Charlie was an operator. He knew he had to join the colonial world, but why not join at the top rather than the bottom? Why not be a gentleman and have a horse and all the accoutrements? And so that's what he tried. Eventually he died about 854 or 5, I think leading some missionaries up to what became one of the missions up near Ebenezer in the mid-1850s. Also, of course, Aboriginal people did fight back, and that was a form of power and agency as well. Their lands were invaded, and right across Victoria you have minor skirmishes. Most of them only lasted for 3-6 months. So in some places, like in the Western District, where there was better cover to hide, and scoria volcanic rock country where they could retreat to and the troopers couldn't get into them, they were able to fight, kill sheep, sometimes kill shepherds, for 6 months or a year or so. But in their fighting they were always restrained, because there are only 59 Europeans we know of killed by Aboriginal people in Victoria. Whereas probably on the other side there were maybe up to 1,000 Aboriginal people killed by Europeans. Now, that's a very interesting statistic, because the gun and the spear were pretty level pegging at that time. These were muskets, muzzle-loading muskets that took 30 seconds to reload, totally inaccurate after about 60 or 80 metres. And that was the accuracy of a spear. Just examples of people being speared twice in the leg while they're trying to load their guns. So it wasn't that the gun was superior. I think this showed moral restraint in a way by Aboriginal people, that they just didn't indiscriminately kill, and also I think probably intelligence, that they were outnumbered in years. So what I think you see on these frontiers is a moral struggle between both groups who believe they own the land. Aboriginal people certainly knew they did. It was their life force, their sustenance, their spiritual place of their stories given to them by the great ancestors. The Europeans, from their point of view, thought that they had the right to be there because the government said they had the right to be there. It was said to be Crown land. They leased it, paid good money for a leasing of land, and so they believed that morally they could be there too. So it was a moral struggle on both sides. And again, we need to recognise that Aboriginal people were fighting for their lands, but also arguing a case for their land at the time. But again, they were realists in many ways, so you see that they have attachments of convenience. And once the hunter-gatherer economy was swept away, and that happened very, very quickly because of the impact of sheep and cattle and also Europeans pushing off land, they then had to work out a way of surviving, and what they did was to engage in pastoral work. And here we see an Aboriginal stockman with a white stockman going off to work, painted by S.T. Gill. They were said to be very good horsemen at the time. This was the opinion of many, many pastoralists. They were fearless in the saddle. And
probably up to 300 or 400 Aboriginal people were working on the front here at any one time. That would include women as well as men, working as shepherds, hut keepers, rouseabouts, all that sort of thing. So another way that they dealt with this invasion of their land was in fact to survive through taking a job in the pastoral work. But of course it was on their own terms, because you read the records and there's many, many pastoralists are so frustrated because they say, look, it's shearing time and the Aboriginal workers have left. They've got some sort of ceremonial business down the track to go to. And they did just up and leave. They didn't absorb the work ethic at all. They often said Europeans were like mules. They worked. Why do you have to keep working, they would say. You know, it's in the record. They had discussions with the pastoralists who wrote this down, or missionaries. Why do you have to work all the time? You were like mules. And sometimes I think they're right. I look at what we do, what I do. And so they worked when they had to, but when they didn't, they just went off. So they didn't absorb, they didn't internalise European values. And it's a lovely quote from William Thomas in his diary that says, at the end of the day, they just throw off their work clothes and they just stretch out and sleep under the stars. And that's because that's what they always did. But they did like pastoral work because with animals, it was often on their home country, so they didn't have to move off. They could still, I guess, imagine their own heads if they were in control and in possession of this place. And I talked about a moral struggle before, and I think this is really important. And I've used the term, things I've written in the notion of right behaviour. Because Aboriginal people actually said to pastoralists that you've taken our land, you need to look after us. You know, we don't have to work all the time for you. We'll work for some of the time, but you know, we expect to be rationed because you're on our land and this is ours. So they do put forward a moral claim. It's reported quite often across pastoral sector. The people said, Aboriginal people said this to them. And later on, when they were placed on reserves and missions, they also took the same attitude that there was a moral right they had to be rationed and to be looked after, because what they had been usurped by the intruders. So we shouldn't forget there's a moral claim. Now this man was an important, he was a son of one of the elders of the 1830s, and Barak in the 1840s was a native policeman for a while. Then he met up with a man called John Green. John and Mary Green were from Scotland. They were very religious people, Presbyterians I think, and they converted Barak in the 1850s up around the Donvale and an area up there where they were living. And Green and Barak got very, very friendly, and they talked a lot about the future. And I think Barak adopts the radical hope of Billy Valeria, that there will be a place for Aboriginal people, that they can remain Aboriginal. So they talked together, and with the help also of William Thomas, they start to lobby the government for land, and in the late 1850s. And then they just take off and they settle on some land up in the Healesville region, but they get moved off, and in fact they're moved off three times as settlers say, no, this is our land and they shouldn't be given this and whatever. But eventually the government, led by Gavin Duffy, the lands minister, who was himself an Irishman and knew about the value of land, had been fighting the land cause in Ireland, the young islanders, he was very impressed by the deputation of Coolin men that came to see him, and said they were dressed like robust agricultural labourers, and he liked their demeanour. He agreed to give them about 4,000 acres of land up in that region, and eventually they settled at Corranderk. And there at Corranderk they formed a very successful community. They started farming, they did well at farming, they built houses that were said to be as good as any of the European settlers in the district. They bought furnishings, they converted to Christianity, because John Green was the first manager up there at Corranderk. And so they are, in all respects, embracing the outward signs of European civilization. They're Christian, they're farmers, they're living in houses like any other settler. And they're dressing, they have weddings. You might have seen some of the pictures of Corranderk weddings where they're all dressed up to the nines in wedding dress and whatever. But the interesting thing is, I think they desire again to remain Aboriginal. And you can see that in the efforts to move them off. Because the government decides that Corranderk's not a good place. First of all, they're too close to Melbourne and there's sort of trouble being stirred up. They say by outsiders, they actually send a detective up to Corranderk to see who are the outsiders, and the detective reports back saying, they're doing it themselves. I'm sorry, but they're doing it themselves. They're writing the petitions, they're whatever. So they start protesting because they see that the government is trying to close down Corranderk and shift it up to the Murray. And of course they see it as their land. And Green had told them, if you make this land work, it'll be given to you by the Queen. They thought they had a compact with the titular head of the opposition, the Queen. And so they start to form together and protest, and they do so in very interesting ways. What they do is they write letters to Parliament. They have marches to Melbourne. They talk to the press. They even go and write and try and see the government. So they're actually using all the political strategies that people of their day use, pressure groups use. And eventually such is their push that they get to have a select committee into Corranderk. So the government holds an inquiry. And the most impressive thing is every adult on Corranderk, who's over 50 people, give either verbal evidence to the Commission of Inquiry or they write petitions and letters. So all of them express their ideas. And it's very interesting what they say. The land, of course, is the key issue, but at that moment of the inquiry, it wasn't an immediate threat that they would lose it. But what had happened was Green had been dismissed, and Green was the person they trusted. In fact, Green had an amazing relationship, which wasn't a paternal dominating one, but more like a brotherly relationship with these people. And he told an Aboriginal man, he almost felt black inside. You know, he understood these people like no one else did. And he was dismissed by the government. And so one of their big grievances at this inquiry was to get Green back, because they had a succession of managers since Green that they hadn't liked and hadn't got on with. But the other thing was they complained about their rations, and especially the lack of meat, because the board was trying to shift them into a market economy, and they said, okay, we'll ration you to a degree, but you have to buy your own meat. The thing is, they didn't get enough money to be able to buy enough meat from the butchers of Healesville, so they were continually hungry. So most of the inquiry is about the issue of rations, and it's all about going back to that form of right behaviour. They said, we are owed rations because you have taken our country from us. So again, it's a moral claim that they're making, which is, and of course that moral claim has to be listened to, because they use the intelligence strategy, I think, of not talking so much about land, but talking about rations. And the government had to listen to them on rations, because it was their right that they were not to be starved on the reserve. That's what convicts did. Convicts, their best leverage was to say, we're not being rationed properly, and the government at the time had to listen to them. And the same in the Navy. If there were complaints in the Navy about rations, the Navy had to listen. So they're using, again, very clever tactics to get their voice heard. And, again, I think you can see what's really going on. Now this is some artwork by Barrack. And if you go down to Federation Square today, you'll see some of Barrack's artworks. Now, Barrack's the head of the community, but the interesting thing is he doesn't paint these until the 1880s, when he's in his dotage. And what he's painting, I think, are memories of traditional society, but also making cultural claims and assertions by, I think, saying, okay, I'm a Christian man, I'm a farmer, but I am also Aboriginal. And so he's making that assertion that we are together We still call ourselves, you know, Kulin people. We call ourselves Corindic people as well, taking the name of the mission, but we still are Kulin people, and we still believe that we're Aboriginal.
So again, I think that radical hope is still there.
Barak actually influences, and I won't go into the story, but he influences the formation of Kamaranganja, because Barak goes up there at one stage and he tells them what's happening down at Corindic and what they're doing, and they're claiming land. So the people up at Maloga settlement on near Echuca on the Murray, and that settlement has been formed and inspired by Corindic, he goes and tells the people, you know, you've got to start agitating for land. So the Maloga people write petitions to the government saying, we want land, we want individual blocks, we want to become farmers. And so they actually get sick of the paternal control of Reverend Matthews, and they move across the river and they form the settlement of Kamaranganja, which becomes an extremely successful Aboriginal settlement. It's led by a group of young men who believe that they can make it in the world themselves, and they're very fortunate that our school teacher arrives, whose name is Shadrach James, and he is a Mauritian. He marries into the community, he becomes a school teacher for about 20 years, and he grows up all those young people to believe they can be as good as whites, and he gives them the skills, the basic educational skills to be that. And so Kamaranganja actually produces most of the early political leadership of Victorian Aboriginal people. And so it, again, it's an offshoot really from Billy Valeri's Radical Hope. And so much assertion do the people show that in 1939 they end up walking off Kamaranganja, virtually the whole community leave, which leaves the manager sort of stuttering, you know, what does he do without someone to manage? But they just get sick of the heavy-handed tactics of the manager there who's in the 1930s. Even, you know, at times pulls a gun on the people and threatens them in many sorts of ways like this. So they move off and they come to live at the flat at Shepparton. And it's on the riverbank, often it gets flooded, and it's a pretty tough place to live in. The punties they built themselves from the scraps on the town rubbish heap, and that's a picture by Seeger of one taken in the early 1940s. So it's a fairly tough life, but again, they're independent, and pretty much independent of the welfare board and of people controlling them. And so out of this community comes a political movement for fighting for Aboriginal civil rights. And this man here, William Cooper, comes to Melbourne when he's 71 years old and starts a political career. How many of us are going to start a political career when we're 71? He starts writing to the paper, he starts writing to Parliament, members of Parliament, and he gets together a petition which he's going to send to the King. And he gets Aboriginal people all across South East Australia signing this petition. And this petition is to ask for a Member of Parliament to be Aboriginal nominated into the Parliament, so there's an Aboriginal voice in Parliament. Because at less than 1% of the population, they haven't got a snowflake hope in hell of ever electing anyone in there. Yeah?
Is that Aboriginal
Day support? No, it's not. It's the Australian Aborigines League. I'll tell you about that in a moment. So William Cooper gets this going, and then he forms his Australian Aborigines League, and then this picture is actually taken at another event in 1939, which of course was the Day of Mourning. And this, 1938, this was the celebration of the 150th anniversary of Australia's white settlement. And so there was going to be a big party by European governments, etc., about this event, but Aboriginal people said, look, 1788 was a disaster for us, so we're going to have a day of mourning and not a celebration. So William Cooper and another guy with a similar body in New South Wales got together in Sydney and they held this day of mourning, and they produced a manifesto which was about 10 pages long, which which said, you know, we have been persecuted, there's been attempts to wreak destruction on us, decimate us, and the real savages are you white fellas, and we deserve a better deal. So it was the first claim for civil rights by Aboriginal people. And there is a man whom you might know, Doug Nicholls. And of course there is Doug Nicholls. So after Cooper dies in 1941, he hands over to the young Doug Nicholls, who was of course a North Cotton and a Fitzroy footballer of note, one of the first, I think, or maybe the first Aboriginal footballer to make it into the VFL. And he was a very popular man. He became a convert to, he was already Christian. He converted to, I think, Seventh-day Adventism in 1932 or 3, and he was a big religious man. And then is mentored by Cooper to take over the political struggle of Aboriginal people. So Doug Nicholls actually forms the Aboriginal Advancement League, which is a different organisation. He had been the head of the Australian Aboriginals League, but he then formed another body with the confusingly the same initials AAL, that keeps getting confused even amongst Aboriginal people today. Or some Aboriginal people, others know the story, but he forms with some white people, Doris Blackburn and others, who formed the Aboriginal Advancement League in 1958. And that is a coalition body, a black-white coalition. Whereas the earlier AAL was an all-black organisation, this is a coalition of black and white. And these were being formed all across Australia, Advancement Leagues, in the 1950s as a way of interested white Australians helping black Australians with greater rights. So Doug Nicholls becomes leader of that and extremely important in that organisation. And of course, this is a picture of Doug Nicholls when he was a champion runner and he later became a champion footballer. And I just want to suggest that there are other ways Aboriginal people asserted their dominance and control, and they often did it through sport. Something like 15% of all Australian boxing champions from 1930 to about the 1980s were Aboriginal people, yet they were less than 1% of the population. There were a lot, yes.
Is that a prize of a cutlery?
I think it is. It's for winning the Nile gift. Yeah, you would have got a cash prize too, maybe about £50. They make quite good money if you won these events. So, through sport, running, boxing, and whatever, Aboriginal people made a name for themselves and started to get self-esteem and pride, and Aboriginal heroes grew up. And young boys wanted to be like Doug Nicholls. They wanted to be like some of the boxers. And eventually, more people came through. So that's another important dimension. And so I think this might be my last slide, or my second last. So what we've seen is Aboriginal people have not lost adherence to their culture. They have adopted materially the things of European society, clothing, lifestyles, food, all those things, but they have not internalised our values, and as missionaries hoped. And I think that's because they've always asserted the superiority of their own way of life. They haven't been impressed by what whites had to offer in terms of ideas, and even when they embraced religious ideas, they often gave it their own twists. So culture has been strong, and of course in the last, say, 30 years, you have to talk about an Aboriginal cultural renaissance. In terms of the organisations, in terms of the cultural centres, in terms of the maintenance of culture and the handing over of culture to young people, there's been a real resurgence. And here you see Margaret Tucker, who was an activist in her own right, and she came from Mutukawa up just over the border of New South Wales. She was influenced by Doug Nicholls and all the others, and she worked with them.
scarcely is teaching young people and showing them possums in folk in a cultural centre. So, you know, their cultural ideas have remained vibrant, and that's part of their radical hope, that they can survive and they can get through this colonial experience, but they can remain Aboriginal. And, of course, these days they're fighting more for things like land rights. This is, at the moment, of the disappointment of the Yorta Yorta news being read out when they finally lost the last court case after 10 years of struggle. But they have used the strategies of white political action and the law to try and get back what they feel is right from theirs. In this case, they lost, but the government has since negotiated with the Yorta Yorta, and there has been some small land backs and involvement in management. Other groups decided to try not the court, the negotiation, and they also have gained small parcels of land. But I believe the government at this point is starting to talk about reversing the onus of proof. Because the interesting thing about the loss of the Yorta Yorta case was the evidence they put up, which they thought was their strongest evidence, that was showing continuous relationships of people with land and continued use of land, did them in, because the judge found that a document, for instance, they produced to show they had protested about land in the 1880s and they requested land, had said that they wanted to settle down and become like white people, or farm like white people. And the judge said, this shows that there was a break in their culture. Now that was a very narrow view of what was going on. Many people would argue, I would argue, there is cultural continuity. But in terms of the law, as it was stated in the way native title was in the Act, you have to fulfil two tests, continuous connection and traditional connection. And he said they were now non-traditional. That's been a very controversial decision, but it's been upheld in three appeals to that sort of decision. But the government is now talking about reversing the onus of proof, because all the onus has to be on Aboriginal people to prove they're continuous and to prove they're traditional. If it's reversed the other way, there may be more chance for native title claims for them. So I'm going to stop now, and maybe just about 10 minutes if people have questions. About anything.
The native police, didn't that idea follow on from colonial practices in Africa and I think Asia?
That's right.
Yeah. The divide and conquer, I think, was a slogan that the British may have used.
Well, people have observed the thought of divide and conquer, and yet what I'm saying is in this case, it wasn't quite the right contract because they made something out of it that was advantageous to themselves.
Of course, it gave them an opportunity to even scores with opposing groups.
It did too, and that's one of the terrible aspects of it. That's particularly in Queensland, where it was a late 19th century thing where they had better weaponry, they had more horses, and so. As in the Melbourne case, a lot of the troopers were used against people that were not their contiguous people, and they were an enmity with, so they had no compunction in killing them. In fact, Aboriginal people would have felt those people were more dangerous than the Europeans who they were able to work with. So, yeah, that was a very terrible downside. Yeah.
Can you say something about the languages?
Well, traditionally there were about 30 different languages in Victoria. There were a couple of, about two or three big language groupings where people within those groupings could understand each other and knew each other's dialects. But of course the pressures of colonialism and of moving people together meant that language was diminished, and some languages totally died out. Others was spoken to the early part of the 20th century. There's people now trying to revive language, but not much is spoken in Victoria. Some words, some phrases are known, and more is being recovered. Because, I mean, the ironic thing is
people like the missionaries who were in one sense aimed out to destroy Aboriginal culture wrote everything down. And so William Thomas, and he wasn't strictly a missionary, he was a protector, but other people, other missionaries and William Thomas left incredible word lists of Aboriginal languages, and they're in the archives, and then even some of them printed in parliamentary pages. So people are able to use that to start to rebuild language. And it's going to be a slow process, but it could be done if people wanted to do it.
I'm interested in what types of relationships philanthropics had with
Well, look, that's important. There was always a sort of a humanitarian strain right through, even within the frontier times, where there was a considerable amount of violence and certainly a lot of indifference and hardness. There were people who tried to do their best, sometimes on an individual level. Some pastoralists never had trouble with Aboriginal people because they treated them well, they shared food with them, they had work relationships, and they got on well. And there were also groups, like there were some church groups, and there was an Aboriginal Protection Society formed at the time of the Myall Creek Massacre in Sydney. And so there were small groups of people who tried to resist the worst aspects of colonialism. And even in the British government in the 1830s, that government was captured by the humanitarian lobby who actually was the group that ended slavery within the empire in 1833, and then they started to look to the place of indigenous peoples in the empire and wrote a very savage report saying the empire, which is supposed to be an empire of good, is actually destroying Aboriginal people, and there has to be a new attitude. And that's why the Port Phillip Protectorate was formed, which I believe did do some good to stop some of the worst violence and to put protectors in to be mediating on the worst aspects of the situation. So, always there has been a humanitarian strand to the whole story that's important not to forget. Yeah?
Just following on
from
the last question, the Aboriginal Protection Society itself, as I understand what you say, is formed. Was that like a coalition as well?
Well, it was, I think...
Right.
Not really, because Aboriginal people in 1838, this is 1838, they just weren't invited into such a group.
So were there any known specifically philanthropic bodies within Victoria that supported the Aboriginals?
Yeah, a lot of the churches. The churches had missions, and their intent was to change but also to protect. That was in the 19th century, and of course in the 20th there's a burst of activity in the 1920s where particularly women's groups start to take up the cause of Aboriginal people, and there are a few study groups formed. One was led eventually by Miss Leeper, who was connected to Trinity College Leeper, and she had a study group of women who were concerned, and they met. They would ask the government questions about Lake Tyres Reserve, what's going on there, what's the education that was being given to Aboriginal children. But there was the Women's International League of Peace and Freedom, other groups like this, who in the 1920s and 30s were sort of parallel with the Australian Aboriginals League and their concern for Aboriginal people. Then those two streams came together in the 1950s for a while, until the Advancement League then came under Aboriginal control in 1969, so then they diverged again.
So thanks, Richard, for a great talk, and I think it's an immensely enlightening talk. And